Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to For the People. Spotlight on a Saturday afternoon at 1:30 Eastern Time. Thanks, everyone, for coming. This is a program where we put under the spotlight the life of one of our members. Today, we're very privileged to have Franklin Green, one of our members, and one of our very senior members. Franklin's been around a while. Franklin, welcome and thank you for coming.
Well, I appreciate coming, and I'll say what you wrote for me at first. Let's see, Steve says, I was born, lived a long life, and died. Steve, I didn't die yet. I want to live a little longer.
Gosh, did I write that? I'm sorry. Obviously, you have not died yet. We just want to find out something. The neat thing about interviewing seniors is that when you talk to them about their life, you're also talking about, really, the 20th century. So what year were you born, Franklin?
I was born in November 1920. And that, according to the rules, that was the last part of the second decade of the 20th century. Remember the argument they had about the year 2000?
Right, right. Literally, you were born in the third decade beginning. Well, that was a good while ago. Where was it that you were born, Franklin?
I was born in Champaign, Illinois, and as a great percent, 90%, 80 to 90% of people were born at home in those days, and I was no exception.
Okay. Did you grow up in Champaign?
No. Well, I did, and yet I went to a residential school in Jacksonville, Illinois, and spent my whole school life there. And at that time, I could see some. Let's say I couldn't see how many fingers a person had at 6 feet, but I know what print looks like. I know colors and all that stuff. But I was in between the high partials and the totals. And tended, let's be honest about it, I tended toward the totals in school to a great extent.
Did you say that you were more drawn to the totals? I didn't quite hear that. You were more drawn to them, or you felt you identified more with them?
I identified a little more with them. I taught many of them the totals how to skate. In those days, we had roller skates. I guess they do yet, but it wasn't near what they have now, skateboards and that kind of stuff. It was just a plain pair of roller skates you'd put on your shoes. I'd take a whole group out, and in those days, there weren't that many cars, so sometimes we'd skate in the street. The streets were in good shape in those days, but that's how it stood.
Well, nowadays I don't think I would take a blind person skating in the street. That's interesting. Franklin, what was your educational experience like in the 1920s and 30s as a blind person?
Well, in the residential schools at that time, things were much different in the sense. Not that there was anything about right and wrong, but the cottage parents, as we called them, in fact, we called them supervisors for some reason or other, were 24-hour-a-day people. and they only got a half a day off a week. And I can remember my when I was a little boy, the cottage parent got $14 a week for 163 hours of work. And of course, much of her life was aimed at the school because she didn't have much else. But that, and then of course as time went on, I went up through the grades, went up through high school, took training of various kinds, crafts, and besides the academic subjects, piano tuning and its allied subjects, which I taught for a while, and came in handy when I ran a music store, which I'll talk about later. So that was the education in the residential school, which I graduated in 1940.
Okay. And how was the Depression for you, Franklin? The 1930s, you were 10 years old and spent your teen years really in the Depression. How was that?
Well, Depression wasn't as bad for me as it was for many people. My dad worked on the railroad and always had a job. He worked very hard, and he was only off for maybe 6 months during the Depression. So we did fairly well, although I can remember so clearly hearing people in 1930, for instance, talking about voting Hoover out of office and getting the Democrats in, which of course happened then, and of course when Roosevelt came in 32, 33. So during that time I used to walk down the street and see men sitting on their front porches in the summertime, and I'd ask them why, how come they were there, and they said, well, there isn't any work. And of course we exchanged chickens. A lot of us would raise chickens even in our yards. And back in those days, we'd bake bread and give it to people. We all had gardens, and so I can remember in August why you'd have baskets and baskets of tomatoes, which were canned and so forth. Things were pretty rough, and prices weren't high, of course, but neither were wages, so it was quite a time.
What a different world you describe. It's fascinating to me very much. So, Franklin, you graduated high school or graduated school in 1940, and then what did you do?
Okay, and after that, I, for a short time, I practiced my piano tuning trade, learning to repair as well as tune pianos, because in those days, and even now, people will never, I mean, many people will never have a piano tuned unless something breaks. Well, I knew a lot of blind people that could tune, but they couldn't use a knife, screwdriver, so forth. Then in 1942, I had an indulgent aunt who paid my way to Rochester, New York, and to the Eastman School of Music. And I had studied music at Jacksonville. And I went there with the idea of learning something, but again, there's where failure works. I simply was not good enough to do what was expected. The director, Dr. Howard Hansen, thought that I was pretty good at composition and actually helped me write out the parts to one. Somewhere in this country is an acetate set of discs with that composition on it that the Rochester Symphony Orchestra played, but I don't know where it is. So that, of course, when I left there, I was very, very bitterly disappointed, and I went to New York. And I'll stop there a minute and see if it's still coming through.
You're sounding great, Franklin. You're sounding great. Go on with your narrative. You said that here is where failure sometimes works. How did you turn a failure into a success?
Well, I went to, when I left Rochester, I went to New York, and I had always been interested in jazz. That and classical music were my two loves. And because my mother listened to a Chicago station which produced the Barn Dance, the country and western, back in the 30s, I even enjoyed some of that because I met some of the people. And that's why I had a collection of the Bristol Sessions of 1927 and learned it all. But anyway, I went to New York to 52nd Street and started to associate with musicians there. And of course I met many, many of the young, of the well-known musicians, Duke Ellington and Gillespie. I think I met Parker once or twice, but I was drinking a little bit too much and he was flipping out on drugs. So I can't remember that too well, but I did make some very good friends there. Unfortunately, so many of them left us early in death, and but it was quite an experience in New York. I did get to drinking a little too much, and some doctor told me that if I kept that up, I would only be around another year. Well, that scared me to death, so I quit. And although I did go back to New York once in a while during the war, I came back to Illinois and started to work for a man that had a piano store. And that was in 1944. And he died a few years later, and I took over the running of the music store. And we rebuilt pianos and organs, and we sold pianos. We did sell a few Hammond organs, which were popular in those days, but nothing, of course, to compare with the keyboards and all the instruments today. Although I do love the organ very much because I had a chance to work on one. And I'll tell you a story about that. So see if I'm always worried about cutting out. I just wonder if it's working.
Oh, Franklin, you are clear as a bell. You're sounding good. Your volume could come up just a little bit, but you're sounding real good, and I'm anxious to hear your story.
Okay, we used to work on organs, and I don't know if anybody in the audience knows what a cipher is, an organ. That means that if you're playing an organ and one of the keys will not stop sounding, something happens up in the organ loft or someplace. So I was in a church one time, and it developed a cipher. And it proved to be way up. So I went into the organ room, climbed the ladders clear up to where the pipes, some organs had pipes sticking out so that they were visible. And so I climbed out there and looked out. And the audience saw me and applauded. That's the funniest story. And I'd heard that happened to somebody before. I don't remember who it was. But it was certainly an interesting experience.
That sounds funny. So, as a blind person, were you totally blind by now, or are you totally blind, Franklin?
Yes, I was totally blind by that time. I had chronic glaucoma starting in the middle 30s. And every once in a while, every several months, I'd suffer severe pain. And finally, by 1942, I was losing it. And, of course, the doctor told me that there wasn't any hope I'd be total. And he was right. Drops and all. It just simply did that. So anyway, I ran the music store then after 1947, 8, ran it until 1954. Took in a partner, which I needed. There was one thing I could not do. I could not drive the truck to deliver a piano. Now, I did deliver pianos. I used to amaze customers by being able to carry the back end while the lifting the, you know, up on the porch a piano onto the dolly and so forth. And I was able to do that without scratching the piano or the furniture or the door or anything else. So people thought that was really something. But I kept that up until the early 50s. And in 1952, the head of the Bureau for the Blind in Chicago were looking for a person to teach piano tuning and other subjects, and he saw my shop and so forth and gave me an invitation to come up and teach. Well, I had not had a chance, except for some classes, to go to university. But at that time, a person with a high school education and some college could start that way. And so I did. And that's a new episode in the life. One reason I gave up the music store was that my partner did what I did in the jazz area, I mean in 1942, and started to drink too much. And I just couldn't handle the business too well without someone to drive a truck and to do some of the bookwork that simply had to be done. But it was a pleasure to run that store. And of course that closes another episode in my life, and we'll start again with April the 5th, 1954. Steve, I'll pause here a minute.
Okay, well, 54, you're about 34 years old, well into your adulthood. Were you married? Did you have children?
No, I'm an old bachelor. I'll get to that. I'll get to that. In April 1954, I came up to teach, and I did teach piano tuning technology. It was a two-year course at the time, and we put a lot of people to work because in those days there were a lot of piano factories in Chicago and suburbs, and so there were quite a demand for tuners. And then a number of my students went out in the field and did the rebuilding of pianos and had a clientele. But it was beginning to go down, and I saw that control over an independent, that is the state demanded more and more paperwork and proof of money taken in and so forth. I always let the students collect the money and keep it themselves. And of course that meant that they had to buy their own supplies, but I was there to go out. I spent many a night and weekends helping them, going out to houses and helping them get over their problems. But that was part of the job. But also, I knew that I thought that piano tuning and its was doomed as far as teaching in a state location was doomed. So I started to teach math, GED, and other subjects, and I got involved in mathematics and business for the vending stand program and so forth. And believe it or not, by 1964, that we moved to a new building, and the director did away with most vocational training, which I did not like. I still think that psychologists are nice to have, maybe, and psychiatrists and so forth, but I think also training for a job is important too. And I fought that all the way through and got in trouble in some degree because of it. But I did believe in vocational training. So anyway, let's just go on to 1963, because on July 10th, 1963, part of the school, we had a radio amateur station. And in 1946, I'd received my license, W9LIR was my call in those days. And I loved to build. In fact, it really was a disappointment when printed circuits and all that came along and I could no longer build. I just didn't care much then. But we'd have a club at the school, and would invite students and show them the hobby and so forth. Well, on the 10th of July, one of the fellows brought a girl up, 25-year-old girl, and named Nanette. And I met her, and we went out for supper. She is a partial, high partial, but she had she had not known about rehabilitation, but she'd got a scholarship from Southern Illinois University and taught for 3 years in public school. And the vocational rehabilitation department wondered how in the world she could do that without their help. I could have told them. Anyway, I met her on the 10th, and on the 14th we decided to get married. 4 days. And it's been 39 years since that time. So that closes another era, Steve. I'd been teaching 10 years and, of course, continued to teach the GED and all those subjects. So then that started to lead to a further phase.
Well, that's very amazing that you knew her for 4 days and asked her to marry you, and you're still married. That's really neat. Why do you think you waited so long to get married?
I don't know. Probably that I am an introverted person, Steve. It just happens that I can entertain myself very easily. In fact, my wife has her hobbies of crafts. She taught craft, as you learn shortly, and so forth. And she has hobbies, and I've got my hobbies. And therefore, it has worked out very well. We get along very well. We get along as well. We tell each other we love them every day. And we don't, we argue, of course. But it's been a very nice sojourn. So anyway, during the Johnson administration, they were spending money like water. So I wondered if I could moonlight a little bit. So I had done remedial teaching, of course, in the GED and all that stuff. So I did some work for the University of Illinois in that particular area. And I'd go over there for evening classes sometimes and teach, gosh, they were big classes. In fact, at one time I had a office and we had closed circuit TV for two classrooms. And of course I learned to use overhead projectors, mark the sheets in Braille and all that stuff, you know, and lectured and had phone hours. It was quite a job. I kept it up for several years until they did away with it, along with the teaching at the school. So that took care of the 60s and the first part of the 70s. And then nothing really happened in the 70s. I kept on teaching the way I had been. Working very hard to get people to get their GED. And actually it became harder and harder because there was just so much they didn't know. I guess you've probably heard some of the surveys of recent about such a tremendous percent can't even locate the United States on a map. Or one of them had, I guess, quite a percentage couldn't locate the Pacific Ocean. Well, you know, I wondered, of course, we used to have a globe of the Earth and had Braille maps. But I wonder if I had a map, if I could find the Pacific Ocean. I know where it is, of course, but I kind of wonder. But the 70s passed, and we continued to work as a teacher. And then, of course, the 80s started, and in 83 and 84, we got our first Apple II, an Apple, I believe it was GS, and we had the, I remember one speech was a cricket, and the other, there. Now this is what being 82 does. I can't remember the name of that other speech program. They were all part of each other. You couldn't hardly understand them, but you got so that you had after a while. But we did that, and of course the word processor came out for the Apple. 64K of memory. Isn't that something? And then, gosh, we got 128K of memory. So anyway, I, of course, immediately got interested in computers. And I saw that many adults lost vision who could type to some extent by the hunt and peck method were pretty helpless. So for a time, one of my teaching areas was keyboard. We called it keyboarding, and we taught that. And then, of course, we began to get computers, telesensories, programs, and so forth and so on. And I can't go on too far because we were still using DOS by the time that I retired in January 1994, 73 years old. I love teaching, but it was getting harder and harder to travel. Although my wife did, in 1978, come to teach at the same place. Talk about nepotism. Actually, it wasn't, because her area was totally unrelated to mine. And they wanted her very badly, so that's okay. So that was it. So that takes us up to about the time I retired, and I've been a little bit leaving out some details, but it's kind of hard to think. You know, memory is a funny thing. I'll remember something and then I'll forget it. And this is very hard to do when it comes to computer commands and so forth. And I have to write a lot of this stuff down. And just I've gotten XP, and it works a little bit different. There's a lot alike, but things are somewhat different, but I'm still excited about it. So that's about the way it goes, Steve. You can see that from the time I left the University of Illinois until I retired, except for the computer area, which I really majored mostly in keyboarding and simple computer work, things just went along as usual. There wasn't anything to, you know, not too much new except so-called teach methods and all that sort of stuff that might develop. So that's where it stands at this time.
Okay, Franklin. Well, you've given us a really good sketch of your life. I feel like, though, you've left out some things that maybe we want to hear about. You said that you got your teaching position without having any real college experience, except for a few classes. Was it always that way, or did you further your education any while you were teaching?
Yes, I did. In fact, I did take classes at the University of Illinois until 1954, and then I came to Chicago and took classes. The University of Chicago had a location down in the Loop during the part of the 50s. It became Washington. Oh, the mayor of Chicago, Washington College later on. But it was university, and then I went to did some classes at Northwestern. And finally, in the early 60s, I finally got my degrees. It took a long time to get the degrees, but I finally got them, and it was a long-term thing in education. It took a while to do it because, of course, it was night work. And then certain things happened. For instance, in January 1958, I was coming home late at night, and someone robbed me and kept hitting me in the eye. And although there was no vision in it, after a few months it began to pain so much that I had it removed and have been wearing double prostheses since. So, but I do have bachelor's and master's degrees at the present time. It just took a long time to do it because I was working at, I was working, let's see, 1946 until 1962. Took me 16 years to finish. Isn't that awful?
I'd say that's pretty awesome, really. You worked full-time, you were married, you went to school, and you finished your goal. And so, what difference does it make how long it took? Now, you got a master's, what, in education?
Yeah, it's just MS degree. And I never did go on further. I just kept that part of it. My wife also has, obviously, she has a degree and she has a master's. And she got hers later on, too, the master's. But I was talking too close, I guess. That's the way she managed it, and that's the way I managed it. So it worked out. It's worked out very good. Well, one thing I haven't mentioned is after retirement, I really have taken it fairly easy, but keeping up to date on everything. With the computer, of course, that's a great part of my life. This site here, for the people, is a great part of my life. It means a great deal to me. All the people that I talk to, and I value all of the ones listening to me now. I value you very, very highly. It's really something to be able to get on and talk to somebody. I really enjoy that to a great extent, and I know that all of you do too, because it's such a nice area. All you have to do is to go to a few chat rooms in Yahoo or other places and get a taste of what they talk about and know that what we're doing is well worthwhile. But last year, we lived in Berwyn, Illinois, next to Chicago, for 33 years while I was working in Chicago. And as of 2001, we moved up here to a place in Nisida, Wisconsin. It's not far from La Crosse, Green Bay. I mean, as I told Steve earlier, we have to drive 20 miles to get to Walmart to shop, or 20 miles to get to another grocery store, but it's like in the city, why, it would take you just as long, if not more, and wear more on your car than just driving from here to there, up here. It's quite interesting. This location, I think, I've counted somewhere around 40 towns that have a population of some, oh, no more than from 100 to maybe 3,000 people. It's amazing how many small towns there are up in this area. So that takes care of the life clear up to now. And I don't know, maybe you have some more questions, because I have left out some stuff, I guess.
Well, Franklin, I do. I also want to open the floor for questions here in a couple minutes, but we kind of brushed over your New York years. I think that's fascinating. You were there in the early 40s, the early war years, and you met Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. Wow. Now, if you can lift the fog a little bit, you say you drank too much. And there's a big life lesson in that, in the fact that you quit on your own. And you now have the experience of knowing that if you had kept on, then you wouldn't be here in 2002, and you somehow quit. But outside of that, and if you want to comment on that, that's great. But outside of that, your New York years, what did you do? How did you support yourself? And what a bunch of interesting, colorful people you must have met.
Well, I went to New York and went immediately to 52nd Street. And as a blind person, for some reason, I was quite well accepted. Well, I mean, you go through those things of, oh, he can do this, he can do that, isn't it marvelous, and that kind of thing. Yes, but one of the first people I met, I don't know if many people know of him, was Art Tatum. Art Tatum was probably the greatest jazz piano alive, and that was alive at the time. And he was a black man. He'd gone to the Cleveland School for the Blind because he had about the same amount of sight that I had. And he loved to go to ball games, so he took me to a ball game once, I remember. And unfortunately, the association caused a lot of talk, and it was really something. I told him, I can remember telling him, I said, Art, you black guys are persecuted, and as blind people were pitied. I wonder which is the worst. Which is the worst? But I did get along because music was everything. And it just didn't make any difference. I remember some of you have heard of Billie Holiday, I suspect. Well, I had a few sessions playing with her. I got to meet Ella Fitzgerald. Some of you remember her, I'm sure. And a number of singers that passed on. And, of course, as I say, some instrumentalists that passed on. Some of them I can't remember. I'm trying to remember names, but I just simply... Claude Thornhill was a band leader up until the 50s. Miles Davis was a real young guy when I was there. And, of course, he made his reputation in the 50s. And, of course, this is all jazz. And then I got to meet, in the classical vein, I got to meet Arthur Rubinstein, Vladimir Horowitz, and some of those people. The reason I got to meet Horowitz, he copied a chorus or a record of Art Tatum's. And he was really an admirer of Art Tatum because of Art Tatum's tremendous expertise at playing the piano. I mean, the runs and all that stuff that he played was just outstanding. And so Horowitz learned that, and then he had Tatum play for him. And, of course, being a jazz man, Tatum played it differently. Played it a little bit differently. The chorus was just enough different. And Horowitz had learned it note for note. And as you know, a jazz musician or probably a rock and roll musician may never play the same thing twice exactly the same. So some of those episodes were the ones that I remember well. And believe it, some of them I don't remember too well either because of the drinking. But I really enjoyed that time in a sense, in that it did satisfy musical desires and taught me that I just wasn't good enough to really, if I ever get to play the song, the record I made, you'll see that it's not bad because I practiced and practiced and practiced until it just had to be pretty good. But someday we'll play that on Sam and so forth. So that's it.
Well, I'm sitting here with my tongue on the floor hearing you talking about sessions with Billie Holiday and Art Tatum. Awesome. And Miles Davis. Jazz is my favorite. And so you're talking history that just puts me in awe. So nice to know you there, Franklin. And I want to talk to you more about it at another time. Well, we're getting a little close here. And I want to give others a chance to ask you questions. I know there are some. So Franklin, thank you so much for talking to me. And by the way, I didn't ever tell that my name is Steve Shepherd. I'm the Shepherd Boy. And this is my first interview, and I forgot to tell my name. So I'd like to open up to the floor for questions. Anyone have a question for Franklin?
Franklin, I want to say you are to be commended. And it appears that you and I have more in common than just longevity of life. You were persistent. You accepted challenges as they came. You had a never give up attitude, and you are to be commended, as I said. And Franklin, I hope you live forever, and I live to bury you.
Well, Jock, you never know. I'll tell you, I'll race you to 100. How's that?
You are on, my friend. You are on. If others can do it, we can do it.
Boy, I just feel we are so fortunate here to have these senior citizens here that just have such wonderful histories, and I have thoroughly enjoyed this again, Franklin. It was just wonderful. I'm curious, do you play the piano now, or how do you enjoy your music now?
Just by ear, Becky. I don't. I have a keyboard, but I think I don't know where it is. But I don't do well at all anymore. In fact, I'll have to tell you the truth. The last time I tried to play, I tried and I actually shed some tears. It was that bad. And it was just disappointing. But I could play chords. I knew my harmony. And that's one thing they used to brag about me in New York, was I could dictate the chorus to them, or arrangement, a band arrangement, and I'd put all kinds of harmony in it. And that was one of the beautiful pleasures of my ability. The one thing that I did forget about, I do have one ability that some people have, and that's tonal memory. Some people call it absolute pitch, but I call it tonal memory because it isn't. I can't. If you tell me to play A440 or tune a guitar to A440, I may miss it two or three beats. And so that's pretty close to memory. It's not exact. And there is no, I've heard some that are closer than I am, but the next time they got a little further off. But that's what gave me the chance to do the music that I did, because I did enjoy the harmony and so forth and so forth.
Okay, any other questions from anyone in the room?
Thank you once again for the interview today, and I've had the pleasure of hearing some of your music. Sorry that none of that is available for today, because I truly enjoyed it. I was wondering, as someone who's lived the better part of a century, what has been the most positive impact and advancement for blind people that you've encountered? And do you think that our society's attitude towards blindness has changed much at all?
That's a very difficult thing to talk about, and I don't know. I know that, see, I can't, it's hard to judge, Jennifer, because today I cannot travel very well because my hearing is, I still hear well in the low frequencies, but as most of you know, a lot of what you here, as far as directionality goes, is high frequency. We all knew that in the study of acoustics. Your bass speaker can be put any place, but not your tweeters. You have to have your tweeters just in the right place. And that's what makes travel so good. I went all over. Even as a blind person, I traveled wherever I felt like. And I even walked along a few country roads, although I didn't like it too well. But I can't judge really. Some things have changed. The mobility methods maybe today are better. I don't know. I've tried, let's say, if you have a mall that is surrounded totally by parking lots, I think it's a lot different than having where I used to shop and everything. I'd walk along a sidewalk and count the doorways because I could hear the echoes from them or feel the steps with the cane or whatever. And crossing that parking lot, you just hope you hit it just right. I tried it a few times, but it's certainly harder than it used to be when all the stores and a lot of that stuff were. I used to love to go to Chicago's Loop at Christmas. There were thousands of people there, and sometimes the sidewalks were so crowded. But still, staying close to the buildings, I had it made. But, of course, they got more parking lots, more parking garages and so forth up there, and then that caused a little problem. But it's hard to say how people react. I belong to a support group here, and my wife and I go every month. And all of those people but me have some vision. And it still comes out from some of those people that most of them are seniors with macular. But they always say to me, "Oh, it's marvelous what you do." So I don't know how much progress we've made, really. Employment-wise, I think that we've done a little better. But I can remember, of course, the one thing I remember that is the World War II, where a lot of blind people got jobs. I was offered quite a few jobs during World War II. What was it? I was in packing. Well, I remember frosting rolls. They used to frost rolls. You do it with your hands. You didn't do it with an instrument. You just put your hands in the frosting and frosted the rolls. I remember that. But how much progress has been made? I don't know. We seem to be getting along better. I think the fact that Social Security, disability and the like helped out a great deal. And, of course, when I first started, there wasn't such a thing. But so I really was forced to do it, or I had to stay home. So it's a interesting thing to think about.
Franklin, well, you taught computers in the later years of your teaching. How does the introduction of computers rank in changing the lives of blind people, or has it, in your opinion, made a lot of difference?
Oh, of course. Of course. I sit here with a scanner to my left. I think I told a number of people about my new scanner that I bought. And it scans a page in 13 seconds, and it does a beautiful job. It does a beautiful job on photography, as far as my son said, the pictures are really something. And so obviously the reading is quite good. And, you know, they all make some mistakes, but so far, well, I've had quite good luck. I just hope the darn thing holds up. I could say that they don't make them like they used to. I couldn't lift my old one very easily, but I can throw this one across the room.
Yeah, this is Nacho 36. I was wondering, you were saying you were a ham radio operator, and your call is W9LIR. I'm a ham operator too. My call is KB3DHG, Kilo Bravo 3, Delta Hotel Golf. And I was wondering, do you still have your license?
I'm sorry to say that I don't. One reason that I don't, when I got my license, wore surplus ham, not wore ham gear, but wore surplus gear was popular, and I love to build. And as I was losing my sight, I was learning to do things such as soldering and so forth. And I can remember the day that one day I was soldering and I was looking down at the solder and I realized now I couldn't see it because I burnt my eyelid. And that hurt. but I was still soldering. And so I built equipment. I built a number of kits. Not really fancy kits. I built a Heath kit frequency generator, a frequency audio oscillator, and things like that. But when the printed circuit came along, so what happened was that I loved building so much that in 1979 I just didn't renew. I'm going to take it again. I'll take my license again, and because there are some things now, satellites and things like that, that interest me. So I've got to get the license back. And now up here we've got lots of land. I've got a 250-foot long wire, and so I can hear stations as far away as St. Louis. And once in a while, even in the daytime, I can hear Nashville, Tennessee, and that's a long, long way down there. So that excites me enough to get it again.
Hi, this is Country Music Mar, and great interview, by the way. It was really, really it's so interesting to me to hear about, you know, the way things were in a time when I wasn't even a glimmer in my daddy's eye. It's kind of interesting to hear those kinds of things. Now, you said that you traveled with a cane. Did you have any cane travel lessons at all in high school, or did that come afterwards in, like, vocational school or college or whatever?
Well, I'll tell you something. We were not allowed to carry a cane at school until I was well in high school. We couldn't carry a cane. And I'll never forget that in 1959, when I was teaching, some of us, the Institute started a summer mobility program, we called it, because mobility teachers had not been, employed yet. And they told me that they weren't allowed to carry a cane because they thought that kids would beat them on the bus with a cane when they rode the buses. So they didn't allow them to carry a cane. So I knew a number of blind people that really traveled quite well even without a cane, but I never did. I could never do without it. And of course, I did mention the country music. I still once in a while, if I wake up at night, I'll tune into some of the truck stops and listen to some of those things. My son got his CDL to drive a truck, and you know, it's one of those things that you think about. And then things, historic things like that. You probably remember me mentioning the Bristol sessions in 1927, and that has the first record of the Carter family and all that kind of stuff. And I met some of those people in Nashville, I guess in the 40s, sometime like that. And so it was kind of, I never lived in Nashville, I just went down there to visit. But it was always interesting to pay attention to different music, whether I liked it or not, to listen to it and see just what it was, you know.
I have one more question regarding school. This may be really interesting to those who are younger and have either never attended a residential school at all or attended a residential school in the 70s and 80s. I know it was with the Wisconsin School for the Visually Handicapped, which is the one that I attended from 1964 to 1977. But before I attended, there were segregations in the sexes of the students. The boys and girls used separate stairways. They sat at separate tables in the dining room. And boys and girls were very rarely together except in class or in like a social hour type thing. And it was very restricted. I assume that it was that way at the school you attended as well.
You are right. And that is exactly why I knew all the tunnels. The school in Jacksonville was full, at that time, was full of tunnels. And I investigated all of them, and I found the one over to the girls' side. Need I say more?
I remember some of the things we used to do, too. Like, one of the male students had a little intercom type thing that you could plug into the electricity, and it was kind of like a walkie-talkie type thing. And I remember us talking to him at night from our rooms and until we got caught.
Oh yes, well, when they built some of the new buildings when I was in high school, we moved over to one of the cottages of the girls' side, and I ran a telephone line from as an aerial. It looked like an aerial and not a telephone line, but we talked to the girls, and I'd let them talk for an hour for a nickel. Of course, a nickel would buy a good big candy bar in those days, but so that's the reason they were given an hour for a nickel.
About the tunnels, Franklin, you just confirmed the point. We do have something in common.
I bet you we do. Oh, gosh. You know, what we did in those days is... one thing I remember doing that really I shouldn't admit doing, but I would quite often take three or four blind people behind me on skates, and we'd skate down the street and turn the corner. And, of course, I'd get going fast and turn abruptly. And, of course, those guys would roll clear across the street onto the curb, you know, into the yards. Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think of doing things like that, but as kids, we sure did.
Okay. Well, Franklin, we've gone well over time here. It's been so fascinating and interesting, and I thank you for being here very, very much. So I want to call to an end to this session of Spotlight. Thank you for being with us. I thank everyone for being with us. So I guess we'll close Spotlight for today. Be with us next week. We'll have another one.